Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 11th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and today we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to answer your questions about the universe. If you have questions about gravity or comets or Mars, where they may have found evidence of ancient life, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email us at voxpop@wamc.org with your astronomy question. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today to help you answer your questions about the universe. Bob Berman is one of the most widely read astronomers in the world. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for these two, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number, 1-800-348-2551, or feel free to email. You can do it that way. voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, how are you? How's the semester going?
Doing good. I mean, it's like the end of week three. It's flying by already.
Amazing.
It's crazy.
And how's the new batch of kids?
They're really good. They're really good. This is my first fall semester where I have a class of mostly freshmen.
Yeah.
Usually I teach upper level students in the fall. So that's been a fun experience for me because not only do I have to teach them the content, but I have to help them learn how to become college students
too. How to behave.
Well, how to behave. And like, you know, you don't have to raise your hand to ask to go to the bathroom in college. You just get up and go. So little things like
that.
It's
been so long for me. I can't even remember. So yeah, that's good. So everything's working out.
Yes, it's going good.
And is the... not observatory, but is the
planetarium.
Planetarium, is that open?
Yeah, we just last Saturday we started our Saturday shows, and I'm doing a show tomorrow night, Friday night at 7 o'clock for anybody who wants to get tickets to come.
Cool. And how do people find out about that?
Yeah, SUNY Oneonta, just Google it, planetarium website, you can grab tickets there.
Bob Berman, what's happening with you?
Well, the big thing is finishing up the 2027 Old Farmer's Almanac, the print edition. You know, about a third of it is astronomy, night by night, month by month, the planets, everything. So that's entirely my thing. And believe it or not, we really care, and the editors there really care about accuracy. I mean, having worked for 30 years for Discover Magazine and Astronomy Magazine, I'd say the editing and the caring about facts is, if anything, higher at the Old Farmer's Almanac, which amazes me because they also have stuff that I'm not happy with, like predicting the weather in Washington, D.C. 2 years in advance. But a lot of our readers, that's why they buy it, for the weather forecast.
Bob, are you going to kind of take over doing the eclipse stuff now that we don't have Mr. Eclipse with us? I'm curious if, like, the Farmer's Almanac's going to kind of take over producing all that information or...
Oh, I could not be as good as Fred Espenak, because he uses computers and algorithms that are of high accuracy, where he'll even predict the path that if you go across this boulevard, you'll get 5 seconds less totality than on this side.
So it sounds like your kind of person.
Oh, it's my kind of person, but I'd rather use his material than try to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Valerie, you sent a couple of great ones, and this one I saw earlier in the week, maybe it was only yesterday, NASA's Mars rover Perseverance has uncovered rocks in a dry river channel that may hold potential signs of ancient microscopic life.
Yeah.
And that was reported yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've heard this song before. What's different about this?
Well, this one is more exciting than what we've seen before. There was a whole big press conference. What they basically found is this mudstone that's got these little flecks of iron in it, but it turns out that it's more of like an iron phosphate, this fancy chemical compound that on Earth only forms when you've got fresh water and you have simple microbes that are interacting with those types of materials, and they basically create these oxidation reactions and create round spots that are minerals, and and it only really happens when there's the presence of life. So this seems to be evidence for flowing water with some sort of simple microbes in it that just naturally interacted with the Martian soil at some point in Mars's history.
Now, at some point, what they want to do is bring as I understand it, this rover drills down, takes samples, and puts them in titanium tubes. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to then someday get them back for analysis.
Right.
If they do finally get them back, and that's been kind of pushed back and pushed back, could they definitively tell if that was biologically created or just some natural process we don't know about?
I'm chuckling because they asked the NASA administrator this like three times during the Q&A of like, okay, you canceled the funding for this return mission, and now there might be literal evidence of life up there that we need to go get. But the idea is, yes, you know, we can't confirm it completely with just the robotics that are on Mars, but if we bring it back to Earth, we can do more tests. We can have it, you know, simulate an interaction and see if we produce exactly the same results. So we really do need to come up with something where we can go back to Mars, grab these test tubes, and bring them back to Earth.
Would it be cheaper to just send some sort of gear that could do it and land it on Mars? Automatically, not a person to run it, but
you mean like our equipment or something like that? They've talked about that. It's just, you know, when you can touch it with your hands and, you know, change things on the go, like having it here on Earth is just better, and then you can have more minds looking at it. So, I mean, we could send some instrumentation up there to do tests, but I think really having them on Earth is ultimately the way to go.
Before I hand it over to you, Bob, Valerie, give me a 1 to 10. What's your confidence that this is anything worth shouting
about? You
know,
well, of all the things I've seen so far, this is much higher than anything else.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't say it's a 10. I'm not going to stand here screaming we found aliens quite yet as much as I want to. But, you know, the scientists really say this is like a 7 or 8. They've tested other hypotheses, you know, because there's other ways you can make these chemicals. There always is.
Yeah.
But it really seems like the most easiest and obvious answer is that there was life in this space.
All right, Bob, you're going to throw cold water on this, so
no,
go.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm going to jump ahead with this because, you know, on past shows over the years, we've talked about panspermia, which is one of the accepted possible ways that life could have started on Earth. That is, what if a primitive life or even the precursors of life are stuffed into cracks on asteroids and things like that, hit a planet like Earth, find a suitable, let's say, wet, oxygen-filled, perhaps, environment, and life then starts on Earth that way. Well, now let's take it to this Mars discovery. We already know that Mars rocks get blasted into space by impacts, and some of these fragments hit Earth as meteorites. We have over a dozen meteorites that came from Mars. So now finding in rocks below the surface possible life, early primitive life, it's natural, and it's not too far. It's going ahead of ourselves, but it's not too crazy to say that, well, once we can really establish that that happened and really look at what is the nature of it, if we really can get to it. In other words, does it have any kind of DNA? Does it have the kind of structure that we have on Earth? We can not only say panspermia is the origin of earthly life, but we can even say where it started. That because Mars, after all, is only half the size of Earth. It cooled first. The conditions for life would have happened there before Earth, when Earth was still too hot to have life.
Okay.
So it could have started on Mars, blasted to Earth, in which case, we've said it before, we've always gotten the laugh out of this line, but it's true, we're all Martians, really.
Well, I always thought you were.
Last time I was a hippie.
All right, this one is weird. Then, Valerie, you said this is from Sky and Telescope. I'm going to read the headline, and that alone evokes James Bond movies. Reflect Orbital plans to launch gigantic satellites to reflect sunlight into regions where night has already fallen, potentially harming eyes, altering sleep, and blocking the starry sky. What the blue blazes did I just read?
This is just wild. And my students and I have been talking about this ever since classes started. But there's this company that basically wants to put up one of those constellations of satellites. But instead of just communicating with them, they want to have a giant reflective device that will take the sunlight and angle it down to Earth and light up like a square mile of space on demand. So if you, for some reason, wanted it to be daylight at 1 o'clock in the morning, I suppose you could call up this company and just say, hey, here's my address, light me up, and they're going to be able to do it, which is just insane.
But just don't look at it.
Right. Well, because
some of those satellites are bright enough.
Right. Well, and they're going to be, you know, very small specks of light, but the reflectance is going to be comparable to, you know, brighter than the full moon and close to the actual brightness of the sun.
That's ridiculous.
So even though it's small, if you stare directly at that tiny spot, you could potentially damage your eyes.
Bob, I don't like this.
Oh, no, we don't like it. No astronomer is going to like this. And I don't see it happening because too many people who would also be affected, a lot of people will be affected at once. And people are going to say, well, that's going to throw off my melatonin production, my biology, and it's unhealthful. And I don't see them imposing that on a square mile at a time. Is hopefully.
I got to be honest. This sounds like one Ernstavo Blofeld came up with, you know? Oh, Mr. Bond, it'll be daylight
tonight. Right?
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And we'll be right back. Don't forget, Lockbox is open at WAMC.org. It's open 24/7, 365. Our Lockbox portion of the fund drive began yesterday, and it goes right on through to the start of the on-air drive October 6th. Feel free to do your part, and it's WAMC.org. 21 minutes after 2, Vox Pop, Ray Graff with you. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Before we hit the phones, a couple emails. This is from Fred, a Big Bang question. I'm trying to wrap my tiny brain around the fact that we say, looking backwards in time, we know all matter started at a single point, the Big Bang. Say, at time zero, all particles were not at that singularity, but close, whatever that means, but at that time, moving in different directions. As time progressed, these particles would also forever move away from each other and yet never start at a single point. Further, if we ran time backwards from time zero, we would see the same thing. The earlier in time, the further those particles would be. So how do we know we have a singularity and a Big Bang? And that's from Fred. Fred, you've perplexed me. I hope the astronomers know what you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically describing what we're observing. Everything is moving away from us, so no matter what perspective you observe from, that seems to be the case. So if you just purely run the clock backwards, if most things are moving away from us, everything is then going to start moving towards us. And, you know, back in the very beginning, that singularity, it wasn't stuff yet. It was just energy. So we have to take time to create the planets and galaxies and things that we see.
Yeah.
But that outward bang, for lack of a better word, is what's pushing everything outward. And it doesn't really matter how the energy was moving in the very beginning. It's whatever force that created that bang. That's really what's pushing the motion that we see. And that's why we believe in this Big Bang theory.
Bob.
And that's not only why we believe in it. That's powerful evidence. But additional evidence is that if it really happened, there should have been, as soon as the universe became transparent to light, that is, the fog lifted. And in other words, when there were neutral atoms, light can travel through that. But the light should have been intense. We're talking about X-rays and gamma rays. But because of the expansion of the universe, that should have stretched the rays so that now, according to theory, they should be down even below the strength of light rays, and they should be just in the radio spectrum. In fact, at the low end of the radio spectrum where there's microwaves. Well, that's just what we see evenly from the whole sky to within one part in 70,000 of uniformity. We have a microwave background corresponding to 2.73 degrees of temperature, which is precisely what there should be if all that happens. So we have two independent, and those aren't the only reasons, two independent reasons to know that the Big Bang had to have happened.
Okay.
As we've said in the past, there are other reasons, logical reasons, why the Big Bang could not have happened.
All right, Nick writes in, did the moon appear larger than usual this month, mainly when full and around 10 o'clock?
Maybe. Kind of, you know, we always get that thing where when the moon is really low, it always looks bigger to us. So it's very possible that when you look at it, it seemed bigger. But I don't think we had a super moon technically. And even when we do, you can't really notice it being just a slight bit bigger.
Yeah, Bob, we've talked about this. I mean, it's an illusion, right?
Yeah, it's an illusion because if you take a cardboard tube, a toilet paper or a paper towel roll, and you look at the moon when it's high or low, they will look exactly the same size. So we see it looking bigger. No question about it. It's called the moon illusion, even though it applies to constellations. Look at the Big Dipper when it's low. It looks enormous. Orion when it's low looks enormous. And that's just because we're comparing them psychologically to earthly objects. Then we see trees, we see distant buildings and mountains, and it gives them size. Whereas when they're high, they're lost in that 180-degree vastness of the sky. So it's a very strong, even if you know it's an illusion, you can't help see these things as the moon is bigger.
There's no atmospheric distortion at the horizon?
No, there's distortion, but nothing that's going to make it bigger.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's going to distort.
What about on the ocean? You have that Fata Morgana effect that where you can see ships on the other side of the horizon. Does that potentially make the moon look bigger as it rises over the ocean?
I love the fact you're the only human being that's ever pronounced that famous illusion of
well, I'm probably not the only one.
Seeing ships or icebergs that seem to float above the horizon. Yes, yes, that's great that you should say that. Yeah, there's of course mirages below and above caused by that thick air. You know, there's 40 times more air that you're looking through when you're looking low. So, yeah, there's distortions, but not a general expansion.
Okay. Unless there's a temperature inversion, right? Wouldn't that possibly make it look magnified?
Yeah, it could. Well, only parts of it, because the inversions aren't big enough to cover several degrees of space.
Enough.
And when the moon, as Valerie said, when the moon does come close to Earth, the difference between its closest and its average is too small for the eye to see. Now, sometimes in books, you'll see the farthest possible moon when it's at apogee compared to the largest possible moon at perigee. And then looking at the page, you'll say, yeah, I can see a difference. But in real life, you never see the largest possible next to the smallest possible in the actual sky. So you don't see that. It relies on psychologically when you're seeing a so-called supermoon. Does it look bigger than what you remember to be the average moon? No.
All right, fair enough. Now, we have two more emails before we get to the phones. Merle from Argyle has been waiting for a very long time, so let's blast through these. Peter writes in, if we are visited from another world, what is the most likely scenario of the following? What form of propulsion would be used? Would it arrive manned or unmanned? If manned, what would the life form look like? Well, that's a whole show or two or 20 or 17.
When you're getting to speculation, you're getting to almost humorous things. We were once asked the question on this show, if we could see X-rays, what color would they be?
Oh, boy.
Well, that's now, you have to really think about that to realize how that's an impossible question. So it's the kind of thing, if there were aliens, what propulsion system they would use. Right. We don't know whether there's such a thing as a warping space.
All right.
Yeah.
You know, like in Star Trek?
Yeah, I mean, we aren't even close to interstellar travel at the moment. I mean, we have ion engines, which are kind of the fanciest new thing now, but that's not going to get you to another star. So I don't think we can imagine the technology yet that you would need. I mean, I wouldn't have imagined my phone 20 years ago being the way it
is necessarily.
So
you wouldn't need
predict.
It though. You wouldn't need it if you had robots with artificial intelligence and you just sent them out and said, you know what? You're going to go 1/20th the speed of light and it's going to take you a long time, but you'll get there.
Yep.
And we'll be long dead when you find it. John writes in, I always imagined that the solar system revolved around the Milky Way in the same plane as the planetary plane. But recently I saw a video that depicted the solar system corkscrewing through the galaxy at a right angle. Is that true, Valerie?
So it's more like a 60-degree angle. So if you think about the galaxy as a flat plane and then the flat plane of the solar system, they're at about a 60-degree angle from one another. So the sun is going to bob up and down like a horse in a merry-go-round as it goes around the Milky Way, and it's going to carry the planets around at an angle. So that corkscrew video that they're talking about is more, it's not perfect, but it's more realistic because of the tilt of the solar system with respect to the galaxy.
Yeah, and we have, remember, disparate speeds. When we're thinking about, like, Earth speed, we usually think of us going around the sun. Well, that's 18.5 miles a second. Let's really think about that. 18.5 miles a second. But there's also us rotating on our axis, whose speed depends on your location on Earth. At the equator, it's 1,038 miles an hour. Not very fast, but it's slower and slower. It's always the cosine of your latitude, by the way, times 1,038. So by the time you're up to where we are at this in Albany here, you're up to about 700 and something miles an hour, about the speed of sound.
Okay.
And slower and slower. Well, that's from the rotation. From our spin, we're going 18.5 miles a second. But it's dwarfed by the suns carrying us around the center of the galaxy at 144 miles a second. That is the real speed. That's the, like, the that's the major speed. So you almost can't even compare them.
All right, let's go to our phone lines. Merle from Argyle has been champing at the bit, assuming he has a bit. 800-348-2551. Merle in Argyle, hello.
I'm biting at the bit.
Go ahead, man.
The question has to do with this asteroid or whatever it is that they said came from outer space.
It's a comet, right?
How can you tell the difference between that and is there a, why couldn't you, couldn't it come just from the Oort cloud?
Okay, all right, good question.
And kicked out.
All right, so there's a reason we know it's from interstellar space,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's two things. One is that it comes in generally at a steeper angle. I'm not sure this one did so much, but usually the ones from interstellar space, they don't stay in the same plane as the planets. They come in from high above or high below. This one was also moving at a speed that was so fast that it would not be able to be bound to the sun, and if it traveled out to the Oort cloud, it wouldn't slow down and come back in an orbit. It would just keep going based on the speeds we see it at. So it's moving too fast, and it's coming in at an angle that tells us that it didn't originally belong to our solar system.
Okay, Merle.
Couldn't it get speed from the Oort cloud? You're saying that the speed and the angle, but the angle is the Oort cloud.
That's way out there, man.
And, no, and there's nothing there that could whip it up gravitationally. You're talking about Eris and Pluto and bodies that have only a tiny fraction of even our moon's gravity. So there's nothing that's going to whip it faster and to the speeds that we're observing it coming in at.
Merle, thanks a lot. But there is that somewhat sketchy, huge planet that's out that way, right?
Yes, sketchy, yes.
Was it Planet Nine, they're calling it?
Whatever they're calling it these days.
No, why? You're skeptical?
No. I mean, I'm skeptical because we believe in Occam's razor here. I'm skeptical until you know, it's proven. I mean, I had a friend who called me yesterday and said, with all those Navy pilot videos showing, we've all seen them, you know, showing those UFOs or whatever we want to call them now, moving at impossible speeds, and it's a number of separate pilots who have them on video. He said, aren't you convinced that there are visitors? And I have to say no, because if you go by Occam's razor, you always have to, if you're into science, you always have to think of what is a alternative explanation that. And I said to him, maybe there's some people up to mischief there, that these pilots are using AI to fake the videos and present them. You know, once you're willing to leap to other creatures visiting us, I mean, exhaust everything else.
You would need a lot of good evidence.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines. It's Mary's turn. Mary in Vermont. Mary, go ahead.
Oh, my. I'm calling because lately I've been fascinated with the infinity to the right of the decimal place. And I heard a thing on the you know, where it goes smaller and smaller, but never gets to zero. And there was something about, you were talking, I didn't hear the beginning of the question about the Big Bang, that there were black holes, that every time a black hole takes in something, it loses a little bit of itself, but never goes to zero. And that black holes, some have been around since the Big Bang, maybe, and may have shrunk to literally the size of a helium atom, I think is what they said. And that, so then they talked about, there was an explosion over the Russian tundra.
Tunguska,
I don't know if it was a few years ago, I don't know.
Yep.
Not in ancient times, but recently. And they never found any craters or anything. But the suggestion in the show was that that might have been a collision with the atmosphere of a tiny primordial black hole the size of, say, a helium atom. So I just wondered.
Interesting.
Yeah, but before you go to that,
fever dream, or what do you guys think about that?
Well, sure. Before you go to that, you're talking about the event on February 15th, 2013, when over that region, Chelyabinsk, actually over Siberia, an object exploded with about the force of an atomic bomb. It exploded 18 miles above, and it shattered windows. And by the way, put this as an asterisk, it injured more people than any celestial event ever has. Previously, only one woman, Ann Hodges, was hurt by an incoming meteor in 1954 in Sylacauga, Alabama. Now we have thousands all injured by breaking glass because they all understandably rushed to their windows when there was a huge light and streak across the sky. Mm-hmm. You and I would have done the same thing, looked out the window to see what was happening, and the shockwave then blew all these windows in. So, yeah, that was, you don't have to go to black holes and stuff.
I think Mary's talking about the 1908 event in Siberia.
Well, she said recent.
No, I'm not.
No?
I just wanted to know if, what is there such a thing, or is this really some kind of, you know, bright idea that doesn't really hold scientific.
All right, Valerie, what do you think?
That black holes can shrink so much that they're barely the size of an atom, and that, you know, they're still floating around. Few and far between, but could have possibly exploded in the atmosphere causing that explosion, because apparently they said there was no crater ever found.
Okay.
So I think Bob is right. It really, I mean, we have actually found from the Chelyabinsk one, we have actually found pieces of the meteorite. So we know for sure that it exploded in the atmosphere, and there's no crater because it fell primarily in water. So we've just, you know, dug under the ice and found it. But with the black hole thing, we do know that black holes slowly evaporate. We've shown Hawking radiation is a thing now. So over very long periods of time, they can degrade and get smaller. But this kind of thing happens over such long periods of time that we've never been able to watch a black hole go from star size to very, very small. But in theory, you could get to a point where it is incredibly small and it essentially just becomes part of space all over again. But we're thinking that that takes, you know, billions, if not trillions of years time. So unlikely that one of them actually collided with the Earth.
But they do have in common, interestingly enough, that they were both of these events were over Siberia. The first one on June 30th, 1908, and this last one on February 15th, 2013, that they should both blow up. Actually, one reached the ground at least exploded just above the ground and knocked down trees for 50 miles in all directions. And one man, Semenev, I even remember his name, was blown off his chair. He was on a porch, blown off about 30 feet through the air, fortunately not seriously hurt. So there's a case, I misspoke when I said Ann Hodges in 1954 was injured by an object from space. So we have to put Semenev also in that category. And now we add that 2013 event. And it's interesting that almost all of it was in Siberia.
Interesting. Another black hole question from Christian. And then we'll take a break and then go back to the phones. It's Astronomy Today. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email. And this one's from Christian. Chris, let's say. I adore astronomy and astrophysics, but have not had a lot of time recently to do true research to refresh my knowledge. But for gags, I suppose, I've always wondered if the Big Bang was the result of a black hole so incomprehensibly massive that it burst and the matter it had consumed over, again, an incomprehensible amount of time, was released with equal or greater amounts of energy, spawning the known universe. Thank you for your consideration. And that's from Christian. This ought to take us 2 minutes to break, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's theories about this, right? This idea of like a cyclic universe where maybe we're going to expand forever and then something's going to happen and we're going to start to contract. We run out of energy. You know, we still don't understand dark energy, so who knows what's going to happen. But if we do contract ourselves again and the entire universe gets scrunched into what we consider a black hole, it's possible that we could be not on the first bang of a Big Bang. We could be on the 10th or the 100th or the millionth. So it's not too far-fetched, although we don't have a lot of strong evidence to support it yet.
And then there's also this. If the current universe, I mean, there's two universes, of course, there's the observable universe that ends at about 13 billion light years from us. And then there's the universe beyond. And we don't know the extent of that. We don't know its inventory. We know nothing about that. But together, one thing is sure, as you head outward to escape the whole thing, you'd have to go faster and faster and faster. And there's every likelihood that you could never escape from the universe because you'd have to go to the speed of light or beyond. And if that is the case, which it may, then the whole universe already is a black hole. And if you look around you, you'll see what it's like to be inside a black hole. Now, this isn't jocular or some crazy sci-fi thing. It's very possible that we are in the middle of a black hole, a very supermassive one, weighing the same as the universe. But if the escape velocity of the whole universe mm-hmm. equals or exceeds that of light, this is a black hole.
All right.
Ready for commercial now?
Yep. Underwriting here in public radio. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Okay. I have so many follow-ups, and I'm just going to leave it alone. We'll be back. Charlie Parker, is that Cosmic Rays? What is it? Yeah, that's nice. All right, hey, you two, we're on the air. 800-348-2551. Yeah, how about that? Let's see. One more email here before we go back to the phones. Nathan in North Adams will be next. Kevin in Greenfield. Oh, am I still a Scorpio? The New York Times had an article this week saying that we're not what we used to be due to the Earth's rotation. Your thoughts?
It's not rotation. It's perception.
Go ahead. Go ahead, and then I'll.
We have a 25,780 year spin, like a top whirls around a little bit in addition to spinning before it dies down. It wobbles, and Earth does that in almost 26,000 years. So because of that, the direction that we face when the sun is at one of the equinoxes, this is the month of the equinox, slowly shifts with time. Now, everyone's always known that. We've known that when astrology was first codified, we're talking about some 2,000 years ago, the constellations were in a different direction. So, of course, if they say that you're an Aquarius, let's say, it means that the sun was in that constellation when you were born. But it's no longer the case because everything has shifted over by a full constellation since then in these 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. So everyone has always known that. Now, for this to be a New York Times story, it's like saying, guess what? News bulletin. Scientists have found that the sky is blue.
Oh,
you know, this is old stuff. Yeah, of course, the astrology doesn't match up with astronomy. We know that.
So this wobble then, is that the reason why the North Star has changed over the millennia?
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my students are actually just about to learn about this tomorrow, and it's the day where I crush half of their dreams because a lot of them are deeply believing in astrology.
Really? Kids today?
A lot of them do. And I show them the chart, and I didn't see the article, but I'm sure it's got the same chart where you look at your original sign, you look at your current sign, and if you go by your actual birth year, which they have all been born since 2000, it is almost a whole month shift. And now Ophiuchus is a constellation in there that the sun passes through. So there's like a week of time where you're technically in Ophiuchus and nobody
knows
what the
heck that means.
I'm
sorry, you can't say that on the radio. Just so you know.
I know, right?
But you're only saying that, Valerie, because you're a Pisces and Pisces people are always skeptical.
How do you know that, Bob?
They're always skeptical, the Pisces people, so she can't help saying what she's saying.
No, I think I'm a Virgo now.
Oh, Virgo, see?
Okay,
see?
How do you know her sign?
Do you have
a mood ring on too?
I'm taking a guess.
All right. Let's go back to the phone. 800-348-2551. Nathan has been waiting patiently in North Adams. Nathan, you're on.
Hey, Ray. How are you guys?
Good. Welcome.
Well, Ray, I have to say one thing for you, though. I appreciate what you do for the radio listeners. You're the only real radio station I listen to all the time.
Hey, man. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. What do you got?
And then the question is, were the Germans right about the moon being a projecting of the Earth, like copy of the Earth, if you look at the moon the right way?
A copy of the Earth? Mm. A reflection? I mean, what do you mean, man?
I don't know.
I've not heard of this one.
A projection of the Earth, projecting of the Earth. I was watching a video about German history, and they said the Earth, the moon's a projecting of the Earth, exactly.
No, I see, totally different from Earth.
No, but I mean, long ago, this is hundreds of years ago, Nathan?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there were those that thought the stars were candles hanging up in the firmament close.
No, that's strange. I hadn't heard of that one either.
No, I've not heard of that.
It almost couldn't be different. The moon has an overall density of 3.3 grams per cubic centimeter. Mm-hmm. Earth is 5.5, so we're different in composition. We have different cores, different amounts of water. They have none, essentially.
Yeah.
Couldn't be more different from the Earth and the Moon.
We all agree that it's not the case, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we don't know if the Germans once believed that, but that's an interesting one.
I found that out like a couple of weeks ago. I was like, now Valerie's here and all the guys are here. It's the perfect time to ask a question.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. That's a good question. You know, and thanks for the call. Is there a subspecialty in astronomy of sort of historical?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of people that study historical astronomy. And, you know, it's really interesting. You can think back to like old paintings and things and people being afraid of comets and thinking that those were, projecting doom onto the surface. Yeah, there's a lot of things
called archaeoastronomy.
Yeah, that we didn't understand.
Remember Owen Gingrich?
Yeah, exactly.
He used to do that a lot.
Yeah.
There was people who specialized in it.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see, and it's fascinating to look at the thought process, right? When we didn't understand the science, what were people dreaming up before we understood what the moon was, what comets were, and things like that? So it's a really fascinating
but
field.
Go ahead.
Sadly, the people who were ahead of their time generally got burnt at the stake, like poor Giordano Bruno in the year 1600. Horrible. He was burned at the stake for saying, listen to this, that the stars could all be like our sun, and there could be planets around the stars in the night sky, and there might even be life on some of these planets. For saying that, he was burned at the stake.
So that curtailed his scientific career then?
Well, it just shows it doesn't pay to be ahead of your time.
All right, let's go to Richard in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Yeah, you mentioned Hawking's radiation. Does it get rid of matter?
So you can't create or destroy matter or mass. It's just converting it into a different form of energy, essentially.
So it's not giving off protons, neutrons, and electrons?
No.
No, it's a bit different. A lot of the Hawking radiation has to do with like matter and antimatter, which is a little bit different. It's not the same type of matter that we deal with. So it leaves in a different form, but it's still something that we can kind of compute and figure out where it goes. It's just not in the same form that we're observing it.
And it goes away from the black hole, apparently.
Yeah, it leaves the black hole's vicinity, and it can just become part of interstellar space.
Okay, but in general, don't black holes collect more matter as they go along?
Sure. Their gravity pulls things in. So if something gets close enough to a black hole, it will fall in and it will become part of it. But when you get down to like the particular scale, you can have, matter and antimatter. The matter can fall in, the antimatter can stay out. And that's just a property in quantum mechanics that we have to deal with that allows that to happen. So this really, you're starting to really get into the complicatedness of taking gravity and outer space and all of those theories and mixing them with quantum, which we don't fully understand and can't quite bridge that gap. So that's why I'm hedging a little bit. Is
good.
Not that, we don't fully understand it yet, but we see it happening. So
and Richard, she's only holding back so that my head doesn't explode again. So I appreciate the call. It's 800-348-2551. Here's one from Frank that came in to voxpop@wamc.org. Would it be a good idea to pre-position a probe in geosynchronous orbit to meet up with a future interstellar comet or meteor?
Well, how would you know where that future one is going to go? You know, if it's a future comet or meteor, how would you know its trajectory accurately enough to put something in its path?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be tricky. And you'd have to have enough onboard fuel to then push yourself away from the Earth. Like, you still have that issue, right? And if you're launching directly off the surface of the Earth, you have to deal with gravity, but you also have the momentum of moving upwards and spiraling out. So I don't know if sitting in that stable geosynchronous orbit is really going to get you anywhere. But a lot of people have asked, when these interstellar things come in, why don't we go chase them? Why aren't we more prepared to do that? So I think we could be more prepared. I'm not sure geosynchronous orbit's the right way.
It takes a lot of money. And if you put something out, and you have to put a lot of them in geosynchronous orbit to make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't know. We'll go here. Why not? This is from Anonymous. Yesterday, during a House hearing, they showed video of what they called an orb being hit by a Hellfire missile, but part of it appeared to have survived and flew off. What do you make of this? Have you seen this?
I have not seen this.
I did see.
No. You did?
Yeah.
Well, then you comment.
Well, listen, I'm not exactly sure that's what happened.
Maybe we're seeing like the orb maybe as a reflectance off of something physical. If you're saying it redirected part of the missile or the orb, which piece broke off here?
What they're saying, I believe, is that the Hellfire missile was destroyed and this thing just kept going. But it didn't. As near as I can tell from the video, it broke into several pieces. I'm not convinced they were under their own power at that time. So I'm not sure. You know, you talked about the Tic Tacs, Bob, earlier. Let me ask you a question. You guys are talking about Hawking's radiation. Let's talk about plasma for a minute. Can you manipulate plasma so that it, like ball lightning, so that it is a discrete thing in space? And if so, would that show up on radar?
Yeah, well, you could, because plasma has charged. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have a charged particle, particles, you can manipulate it with a magnetic field. So that's the whole idea with those new, Valerie alluded to it briefly earlier, new kinds of propulsion that create plasma. And once you have matter and antimatter, for example, that's a good example. Either one of those is can have a charge to it. And then you can funnel it with a magnetic field and then use it for your purposes.
Would that plasma, that discrete plasma, however you control it with magnetic fields, Valerie, in your estimation, would it show up on radar as a solid object? Would it mimic a solid object?
I mean, maybe if it was dense enough, possibly.
And you had enough of it.
Yeah, like, I don't know the exact details, but I feel like you'd have to have a lot to be able to see it and detect it. Because it would have to interact with light and I don't know.
Remember, the sun is largely plasma.
Yeah.
And we have no trouble detecting that or seeing that.
Sure, of course. But if you were going to do it on like a small scale, that, you know.
An experimental weapon.
And I feel like, too, you would be able to very easily detect the magnetic field maybe even before you could see or detect the plasma. You know, if you had the right instruments, the magnetic field you would need to control this type of thing would have to be so strong to make it effective that I feel like that would be more easily detectable maybe even than the plasma on the radar. So, I don't know.
Okay. Well, just a thought. The number here is 800-348-2551. We're in the tail end here, last 5-10 minutes of astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Jose writes in, I witnessed this red light out in the night sky zigzag. As quickly as it appeared, it disappeared. I was stunned. All I could do is just sit there and think. Now I heard, either this year or last, a discovery called the Einstein zigzag particle. Is that discovery true? I've not heard of this. You guys?
I haven't either.
I've heard that expression.
Einstein zigzag.
Generally, if you see discrete lights, like taking a point-like shape, and they're moving in any way, the first thing you should think, using Occam's razor, is that it's a artificial thing. It's a helicopter. It's a plane. It's somebody's drone. It could be anything like that. Could move and can move in a zigzag shape. You shouldn't immediately go to that. This is an unknown phenomenon of nature that no one's ever found before. That it would be violating Occam's razor.
Valerie, you're cheating, and you found something
on
your phone.
Thanks to the power of the internet, I now know what the Einstein zigzag is.
What is that?
It's they're just basically talking about gravitational lensing. So if you're looking at like lights in the sky, which are distant galaxies, there has been some evidence where you have two galaxies aligned in just the right way, where light's coming from one side, it's deflected by one galaxy and then deflected by a second galaxy back in the direction it came. So as it's coming towards you through space, it appears to zigzag.
Oh, cool.
And what we see is kind of like a reddish colored zigzag structure up on the sky. But that's not something you would see happen in real time.
It
you
be
would
a
just
visual,
see yeah,
movement.
You'd see like the line that is there, and you need a telescope to see it. So
that
this
is
can't
crazy.
Be what
I mean, we've seen pictures. I've seen pictures of this lensing from large objects out in space, and that's very cool. So I've not heard about that one.
Yeah.
All right, Bob. You had mentioned that Saturn is going to be in opposition.
Oh yeah, this is the month that Saturn comes closest to Earth. That'll be on the 21st, and when it is at opposition. This year, it only happens every 15 years, you won't see rings. Even if you have a good telescope, you'll see a straight, bright, white line going through it because the rings are edgewise to Earth right now. And that means Saturn is having its equinox, and that's one day this month before we have an equinox. Our equinox will be on the 22nd. Usually it's September 23rd. And that brings up Shall I get into the seasons, or is that too long?
We have a couple of minutes. Winter is shorter than summer,
I don't think one person in a thousand knows that that the winter, if you divide the year into two halves this way, by saying from this month's equinox on September 22nd, it'll be this year, to the March equinox on March 20th, or compare that to the other half of the year from March 20th to the next year's equinox, call those two halves of the year. Well, the cold season for us in the Northern Hemisphere is the one that's coming up. It turns out that's a week shorter than the warm season. In other words, we get more warm weather. We get a whole week, or very close to it, more of that warm half of the year than the cold half of the year. How come everyone doesn't know this? It's good news.
Because it doesn't feel like it, Bob.
It doesn't feel like it.
It feels like winter lasts forever.
How come we don't know about it? And the answer is fascinating, and that's our calendar system. Number one, as we all know, we have months with different lengths. But the longest months, let's say July and August, tend to crowd in the warm season. And the coldest month, February, is in the cold season, the shortest month. Secondly, is what's coming up this month. We have a delayed equinox. We have the September equinox, usually on the 23rd. This year it'll be on the 22nd. But all the other equinoxes, solstices, are on the 20th or 21st. So the fact that we have a later one does the other half of the job of disguising the fact that the year is unequal and that we have a shorter winter half than the summer half of the year. And part of that reason is coming up this month with that late equinox.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Valerie, what's happening at the, you said the planetarium is going to be open for business this week?
Yes, sir. We've got shows themed around the solar system. I'm going to be talking about some of the latest discoveries, including the Mars rock discovery. Now I got
to
add that in before tomorrow's show. So we'll talk about
that. Rewrite the script?
Basically, yeah. Go fix things. And my student's got, he's going to start featuring his show in October. It's Constellations Across Different Cultures.
So okay, so learn... this is something I asked about the other day, mm-hmm. the last time you were on. You know, sort of how culturally this is a horse, this is a pig, or whatever they are.
Right. And everybody imagined a bear. Like everybody.
Yeah, there seems to be some uniformity to
mm-hmm.
it.
There is. And so many unique ones, but also some interesting overlap. So.
All right. So, and once again, if people want to find out about that.
Yeah, SUNY Oneonta Planetarium website, tickets are available now.
How do you program that?
Well, there's a special piece of software that we use where we can create our own buttons and kind of click through and set the date and the time and the motion that we want to see. And there's actually our own coding language you can learn that lets you literally code the planetarium.
That is so wild. I've got to get there and I've got to check it out.
I'm teaching the class in the spring. Come join your daughter. You and your daughter can sit in my class together. How fun would that
be?
Well,
I don't know. I certainly can't help her with her homework. That's for sure. All right, Bob, if people want to find out about your comings and goings, and where are you headed next?
Alaska for the aurora. Ooh. That's our secret place at the Arctic Circle.
Right.
And then next summer for the total solar eclipse in Spain. We've leased out a winery that's also a monastery, 1,000 acres in the clearest part of Spain. And how do they reach me? Just use my name with the word tours.
Oh, search Bob Berman Astronomy.
Yeah, and the word tours. Yeah,
no, but what could possibly go wrong bringing a tour to a winery? I mean, come on. What's going on?
Sounds fun to me.
I'll tell you what, that'll certainly make astronomy very exciting. We have another call. It's about quantum physics. Unfortunately, John in Otis, Massachusetts, Mr. Basie's going to play right now, and then we're done with the show. So you'll have to get that one in next month. Valerie Rapson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Bob Berman, thank you.
Pleasure.
Support comes from Windy Hill Farm, Nursery, Orchard, and Garden Shop, Great Barrington, offering hardy mums, fall blooming perennials, ornamental grasses, locally grown colchicum bulbs for planting, and over 20 varieties of hydrangea, WindyHillFarmInc.com. Sure. I probably pronounced most of the plants wrong, but I don't know much. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to Bob and Valerie for being with us. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screen by Andrea Leong. Thank you, Andrea. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, boy, tomorrow it's a Food Friday, and this one's all about garlic. The vivacious Samantha Simmons will be hosting, and she'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.